very much, Kamari, for this very dense and thought-provoking talk. I think there are many questions around. Maybe I can start off with the first one, and then we'll take the round. In what I understood from your talk, you seem to suggest that this legal temporality is kind of opposed to local perceptions of more historical imaginations of collective guilt and colonialism and so on. So I was wondering, as a kind of hypothetical assumption, maybe you know it from your further research, do you think that the reactions locally would have been different had the case been heard, or was the case being heard in an African court? So would the locality of the court, rather than the fundamentals of Western legality, which presumably would be the same in an African court, make a difference, or do you think that's not really a relevant issue?
Yeah, no, I think it would, and it's actually the part of the larger argument that there's a geotemporal dimension here, and the perception matters, and it's all too easy to think of justice in relation to its alliance with a colonial past, and so the signification and the resignification is certainly at play. And much of the work that I'm doing now is about this African court and the prospects, which raises a whole set of other questions. But yes, indeed, I think it matters. Space and geography matter around the designation of what is a legitimate judicial institution and what it's doing. But it doesn't attend to the more technical question. So what we're talking about is the symbolic realm and what this means and how it's seen as legitimate or not.
But just to follow up on that, do you mean then that the kind of argument against the legal temporality is more like an epiphenomenon or a derivative, what do you call it, argument, which ultimately seeks more what is more concerned with who is actually speaking justice or giving justice here?
Yeah, I think that matters, and it's conceptual. It's conceptual. It's about perception, and its manifestation matters. Now, but you also asked a sub question about the actual case, that if there were a case and if the evidence were allowed to unfold, would that change? And I think it would over time. But you know, as we know, the Kenyatta case has been thrown out. And if the case were heard in Kenya, which was part of the deliberations, I didn't really go into the details of that. But the deliberations are quite interesting because there were a lot of naysayers who felt that they couldn't perform a judicial objective process within Kenya because of the recognition of corruption and the doubts around whether or not it would actually be a fair judicial process. Mm-hmm. But and that's part of what I think is at play here, that there's a recognition of contradictions that and that they sit alongside each other uncomfortably. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Of justice, I see the perpetrator right in front of me, and this is sort of what affects me, and the legal system does not touch upon it. Whereas the other quotes that gave sort of, you know, this broader narrative, to me it sounded, you know, about colonialism and injustice, etc., it sounded sort of, you know, that they were articulating from a totally different position,
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think by an anthropologist, right? Yeah, legal, from what I remember, from meeting some time ago, years ago now, yeah, in Max Planck, I think. But yes, there's a difference that makes a difference, that we interviewed many, I think about 150 to 200 victims, people victimized by violence, and there were different layers and entry points for thinking about culpability. And so one part of the paper really has to do with those macro conceptions and the ways that people are contesting legal time and thinking historically and thinking about the political and ethnic dimensions. And the other part of the paper, I didn't go into it as much, but for every one of the female voices that I highlight, there are 10 to 15 to 20 others in which the questions of proximate violence matter, especially in rape cases, in cases where women, mothers saw their daughters raped by someone who they knew, a foot soldier, a police, someone that wanted money, someone who didn't like their ethnic group and would, you know, chant certain refrains while committing the act of rape. And so in many ways, many of those people were quite defiant that Kenyatta did not rape them. Kenyatta didn't rape their children. And depending on their ethnic alliance, they might have said, and this is a part of the paper that I didn't go into, but there's a whole section where people actually admitted that Kenyatta was culpable, but that Kenyatta was a freedom fighter. He protected them, because what we had is Ruto's party, the ODM, who attacked first, and then the Kikuyu who responded with violence. And ultimately, it's seen that Kenyatta deployed the Mungiki, these thugs, these gang members, to defend. And that it isn't that people aren't saying that they don't think that Kenyatta was responsible for mobilizing violence, but that Kenyatta was responsible because he was a freedom fighter. He defended the people from the land because the Kikuyu were displaced historically. And if they simply just let the ODM come in, they would have been further violated. And so part of the trope is that it's irrelevant whether or not Kenyatta mobilized support, that Kenyatta defended his people just as his father defended his people through the Mau Mau during the pre-colonial period. And so there's an available trope, and this is much of what the book is about. It's about the available tropes that exist, that are deep, that are inscribed in people's everyday life, that are historical, that are present, that are easily used to then fulfill a particular emotive narrative. And so this is the complexity that sits side by side. It's not culpable, did they kill? It's who is fundamentally culpable has to do with a whole range of other calculations. Yeah, so I've been working in this area for many years, and so in the earlier work, certainly it was the object of inquiry for me. It was both how people understood judicial and non-judicial modalities and what these other modalities meant in relation to what justice could be, what the possibilities were. In this context, when we interviewed some of the Mau Mau veterans, for example, in the highlands in Kenya, and it's certain that there is a trope that's available to people that is about traditional justice. And, you know, we did a whole mapping of what the modalities were and what people understand them to be. The question is, to what extent is it operative now? And, you know, what is traditional justice really at the present time? And in many cases, with the remittances from the British government, et cetera, there are moves to revive these modalities. But, you know, they exist alongside the contemporary period where what is tradition is really a manifestation of our reconceptualization of those practices. They do exist through, certain logics. So one might think of, and we talked with some of the Mau Mau war veterans about parables and stories and how those parables and stories were refractions and reflections of earlier forms. And so in the book, in one of the chapters, I have a whole section on those other forms and how people understand those forms to exist. But it's not a preoccupation, because in many ways I'm, at this point, in many ways I'm concerned in this book with contemporary manifestations and how people are engaging in what I call in the larger book forms of legal encapsulation through the pro-accountability movement, and what that has to do with its imbricated response with other forms. And so it's a different domain, but it's certainly important.
Thank you very much. I really like how you put your whole idea of effective reattribution into the larger African context. You mentioned Goni at the beginning. You also mentioned Gbagbo and Abachir. And with regard to what happened last year when the Sudanese president came to South Africa and was not arrested, I happened to be in Namibia at that point, and I talked to friends about that. And one of them said exactly what you mentioned, saying, well, what is the ICC anyways? Putting it more in a colonial context, saying what is their right to apprehend an African president, while the other one was just making jokes, saying, well, Zuma's just looking for a place to go to after he was not president of South Africa anymore. So how would you relate to this incident in the larger context of your idea tonight?
Yes, sure. There's a waging debate about the indictment of African presidents. And as you can imagine, there's an emotive component that's part of this. And in the larger book project, of course, I map these questions of immunity of African presidents and the way that the new African Union Court with extended criminal jurisdiction also has a provision, 46 bis, that insists that heads of state that are serving in office are not have personal immunity. And so there are interesting debates about this question. So on one hand, there's the existence of customary law, and part of what I've been doing at the AU, the observations of diplomats and others negotiating this new treaty, the Malabo Protocol for the African Court, part of the discourse is that customary law exists and presidents have immunity. On the other hand, Article 27, the Rome Statute, removes this immunity, right? And that by subjecting a state, by subjecting itself to the jurisdiction of the court, it's removing its immunity, the immunity provision. And so on one hand you have the African Court, on the other hand you have the ICC, which is saying there's absolutely no immunity. On the other hand you have international customary law and a range of other bilateral treaties with states that have led to the extradition and the universal jurisdiction, so Pinochet, Charles Taylor, etc., and their extradition. And so on one hand, there's significant amount of confusion about what is permissible and what isn't. You know, that there's a domain of, there's the treaty system in which that removes particular types of immunity. There is customary law, and then there's this new emergent court that's being conceptualized that isn't in force yet. And what interests me in relation to that is, yes, on one hand, al-Bashir did travel to South Africa. He was not arrested, and he left very quickly. And shortly after that period, South Africa threatened to withdraw. And from what I understand, the proceedings, the discussions are still underway with whether or not South Africa will withdraw. Of course, that conversation reemerged at the AU recently. And so it's an important domain. And in one of the last chapters of the book, I have a whole chapter on this debate about immunity. And what interests me here around reattribution, then, to get really to the heart of it, is that The idea of an African leader and not an American or European leader being extradited constantly, one after the other, represents a set of manifestations to which people have responses, and that, you know, this court is racist, that, you know, there are a range of responses that have to do with a fundamental dismissal. And culpability is often narrativized in a particular way. And so what interests me, of course, is the way that that culpability is reattributed, that blame is placed on a racist institution. But in fact, if you think about the conditions in which it is African leaders and not European or US leaders, much of that has to do with the global international system. It has to do with the crimes that are under the jurisdiction. It has to do with the conditions of the possible, as it were. But the project and my interest here is in the discourses and the narratives, the tropes, and that are available to people around which these emotional aspirations then become manifest, despite the realities of legality, that, you know, there's customary law, there are provisions, there are certain things that are agreeable or not. What are the obligations? And so there are more technical questions. And so what interests me are what tropes are available, and what are the histories of segmentation that make possible some tropes and not others. And I'll just end by saying that I've been quite interested in what some of my informants call de facto immunity. So Bush or Blair, et cetera, have de facto immunity, even though the England is under the jurisdiction of the court. Or so there are ways that the viability and the legality of certain types of violence are deemed legal, and other types of violence are deemed illegal and available for extradition. And it's really the way that people are conceptualizing these narratives, and then the emotions that are available to them as a result of the ways that they're conceptualizing it, that interests me, certainly.
German law calls something like attributability. So a normative element that says, well, certain causal factors have to be taken into account to assess responsibility, and others who are too far away from the act cannot. So maybe a devil's advocate question at some point, if you enlarge the temporal element, and I think at the moment of attributability, the temporal element is more important. Is it actually reattributing culpability, or is it not simply diffusing culpability? I have to think, for example, for a very compelling argument by Hannah Arendt about what we call in the German debate often collective culpability of the German people for the Holocaust. And Arendt said, well, where everybody is culpable, nobody's culpable. Yeah? And she criticized this notion.
In fact, I start my paper with that quote. It's right at the top of.
So the question is, where is the strategy, or isn't a widening of temporal scope not also at some point a strategy of, well, decoupling? That's not an English word. To defuse the issue of culpability altogether, rather than reattributing it, for example, to colonial legal regimes. So, because are there really then more culpable?
That's, yeah, great. It's a provocative question.
Sorry.
No, it's good. I'm not a criticism. It's provocative because it's pushing me to think about why I don't like your suggestion that in fact we're talking about a diffusal, and perhaps I'm not. Reattribution is at play here in part, and this is something that we talked about earlier, that what's at play in this domain is politics and legitimacy, yeah? That, so to diffuse I mean, one could say technically, yes, and in terms of legality, yes, there's certainly a diffusal when you go back to the time and there's no agent to which you can ascribe an act. And now we have a lawyer asking this question, so that's a great, I mean, it makes sense that, of course, that would be the suggestion and the provocation that there is no principal agent that's to which one can attribute this act. So in much of the data, the responses are very general. I mean, people, as you saw, you know, the first quote, you know, I would go back to colonial times, and there are these, you know, where people use land and land injustice as a marker for earlier settlements and forms of displacement. And so technically, I think you're right that what's at play is a diffusing of causality because there is no agent. But the fact that there is no agent is not relevant to non-lawyers, that the absence of a perpetrator or a causal agent is irrelevant, that the colonial, that the idea, the icon of the settler, the icon of the colonial agent, the icon of the act of displacement is in of itself a quite specific modality through which attribution happens. And so I guess my pushback would be that it's quite particular that outside of the law, there is a designated iconic figure that stands in for a range of things that produces an emotive response that is, for me, the measure for making sense of what's happening. Yeah. But it's something to think about, certainly to think about more, and I'm sure you'll push me on some more later. but thanks for that, yeah, question.
But maybe to follow up on that, because I had a question going in a kind of similar direction, you could say maybe in law it is not a reallocation, but it's a diffusal. But in terms of a broader recontextualization of causes, effects, and responsibilities, mm-hmm. it might be a reallocation. But then it leads to the situation where it becomes not processable in terms of law anymore. Mm-hmm. And then the question is, what is the better alternative? So the question I had is, if you put that into a broader context of transitional justice measures, for instance, say, well, retributive justice seeking in terms of criminal law is just one mechanism besides many others. The whole debate about peace versus justice, truth versus justice, and it comes to mind. And my understanding from that, also from my research in South Africa, where I work on land reparations and land restitution, mm-hmm. as you know, is that very often people seem to be always seeing the grass to be greener on the other side. So whatever measure you're actually offering, there's always a very strong element of discontent. So to put it differently, you could say, well, whatever the state or whatever mechanism is being put in place, there mm-hmm. surely will be actors who will be dissatisfied. And if you come up with reparations, then I'd say, well, what about justice? If you come up with justice, then I'd say, well, what about the proximate perpetrator next door? Mm-hmm. So what I'm trying to get at is, well, there might be an element of people being positioned in certain ways and seeking certain forms of restoration, mm-hmm. repair, but isn't there maybe also a more foundational, effective dimension of an excess of injustice, of a sentiment of injustice, coming back to the emotional part of it, where people just always end up being dissatisfied with the solution that's being offered because the act committed against them is of such a magnitude that whatever kind of mechanism we offer them, the remedy will never be enough. So is there a kind of excess in injustice which might be positioned differently, but which ultimately is not that dependent on the specificities of the law, but rather on the dissatisfaction with whatever kind of institution you set up for them?
Yeah. The dissatisfaction, I think part of what's, I really like that question, because it, on one hand, it pushes me to think about, and in some ways I ended with this in thinking about reparations and the Alien Torts Act and these forms of compensation that are at large, that are ways that in many ways states are attempting to deal with historical crimes, not through the law, but through these deeply structured political performances, right? Not through strictly legal interventions, but through symbolic and performative mechanisms. The diffuse component is that what you have in many of these cases are continuing crimes. I think the crime of apartheid is an example of that, that they'll never be satisfied because we're talking about a modernity of injustice and a modernity of forms of social organization that are fundamentally about the past, but they're about their manifestation in the present. And through these remedies are symbolic forms, but they can't address the past, certainly. And so, but I wouldn't necessarily, are you suggesting that then diffusion, that there's a way to loop back into the diffuse nature of these contemporary remedies?
I'm just struggling, and it's more of an open question also with regard to my own research, to what extent the dissatisfaction that people express is to be taken serious as a political statement about the status quo and the way how things are being dealt with, and or to what extent there's also a kind of, it's just the greatness of the injustice they experience. So for instance, when people come up with a question of colonial injustices and the dispossession since the 18th century, are they truly suggesting that the actual perpetrators of crime in 2007 should not be prosecuted because of the historical injustice of colonialism? Is the act of historical land dispossession justifying the individual rape of your daughter? I'm doubtful that this is really what people mean. So where does this, and I think that's what you nicely showed also, the effective pitching, so to speak, in their statements. Where does that come from? Where's the source of this agitation at that moment? Where to locate that in a theoretical sense? I think that's a very interesting question, also very compelling for our research in methodological terms, how to make sense of these emotional responses. So where the locus, where's the place where to put that? And I'm struggling with that. To what an extent that is a position to be taken serious as a political statement, or rather a kind of excessiveness of the effective overwhelmingness, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, but in many ways, I mean, the answer to that is often the answer that I often give, which is that there's ambivalence in these responses, constant ambivalence, that at once a speech act is, a speech act does many things when one, you know, an articulation of a colonial manifestation is not just that, it's a way to talk about social injustice, it's a way to position oneself in relation to the other, it's a way of saying something about someone's social values, and I think that the question you raise, I mean, it is an empirical, it's a question about how we then parse and make sense of this field data. So someone is on one hand responding to a question. The question might be, who is culpable? But they're doing many other things that are far more important than saying this person is culpable, that person is culpable. As many of you know, in collecting data, that's the case. And the key is to read through the ambivalence and to reckon with the ambivalence, which I think is what we've tried to do with some of that material, to think through what that ambivalence is. But it sounds as if your question about the locus, where is the locus? In many ways, I want to somewhat refuse the question, where is the locus, and suggest that that the locus, the node, the deep sentiment really depends on the moment. It depends on the type of question. It depends on who's asking it, under what context, what the order of my question might have been. And what we also found is that there was the very woman who asked, who said, this man who stole my goat is the one who should be culpable, not Kenyatta, is the same one when asked later whether or not the trial should happen. She said yes, she thinks that the trial should happen. And that ambivalence is certainly of interest there, but she was quite adamant about what was not happening, and that the majority of her sentiments were about what wasn't happening, and that she wanted something else to happen that wasn't happening.
Okay. I think we are far over time already. Is there any other urgent question? Otherwise, I suggest we just go to the Alte Dorfen and continue over dinner. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for your questions.